Yes, it's R. And I apologize. I've tried to get this to be fixed, and I can't find out what the problem is because I didn't sign up with my Zoom account like that.
Did
And
you, are you on a computer?
yes.
So if you move your cursor over your own picture, you should see a
Okay.
little blue thing comes up that says mute, and then there's three dots.
Oh, rename.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
And you might have to do it over and over, I don't know.
Okay, that's okay. Thank you. I didn't know I could do it like that.
There's a default in Zoom too.
Well, thank you for coming, everyone. I'll go around and say hello, and then we'll get started. Starting with Drew and Linda R. and Tessa, Franklin, Susan, Peter, Bob K, Jim, Mark, Marv, Jinryu, John, Karen, Gathel, Mick, Aaron, Tyler, Alice, Mac, Sam, Linda B, Ken, up very, very early, impressively early, Sabrina and Ruth Ann. All right, so I should say something about the process and the option of receiving the precepts and formally becoming a Buddhist. So things, it's different this year because we have people who would like to receive the precepts who are afar and won't be able to come to an in-person ceremony. And I think I want to so the idea in our lineage is that this receiving the precepts in Jukai is a very a fairly accessible and open thing. This is actually how it's done in Japan in the Soto tradition, is that there's usually a big Jukai retreat, which is something that my Dharma Rain Zen Center where I train does every 3 years. They call it Dai Jukai or Big Jukai. So it's a week-long intensive retreat. And so in Japan, people will do this retreat multiple times and receive the precepts at the end of it or participate in the Jukai ceremony. So this is our version of that, is that people vow to follow the precepts, and then in the ceremony you receive a wagesa. I don't know if there's anybody wearing one right now. Bob, are you wearing one? There we go. It's a strip of cloth, and it's and Drew, and decorated with a beautiful, not that you're going to be able to see it on Zoom, but a beautiful little decorative knot, and that is your sign of your vows. And then we do have another kind of, if you've been around for a number of years and you want to deepen your commitment and you feel like this is like this is your lineage, like you really want to, almost like a joining the lineage ceremony. So that is where someone then sews a rakusu and receives a dharma name, and it's another step of vows. So the Jukai we make fairly accessible, but on the other hand, it's ideally it's not something that you just like show up off the street and do, right? You want to have studied the precepts. You want to have practiced with Sangha long enough that you really have a sense of what Soto Zen is offering. You know that it's useful to you. I mean, it's not that you never go do anything else or that you're permanently committed to it, but maybe you do feel that way. So it is a way of deepening your vows, but I say, regular participation for least a few months, and then trying to attend all of these precept classes. And if you can't attend all of them, to listen to the recordings of the classes, and also read one of the precept books, and then we need to meet one-on-one via Zoom sometime probably in May, so that you will have taken some of the classes already and then can clarify, but also to let me know sooner than later if it's your intention to receive the precepts, and then you let me know. And then we have somebody who's volunteering. It's really wonderful. She is making all of our wagesas. And so the idea is then that I would send it to someone, and they need to recruit someone, some other human being, to participate in the ceremony, so that they would put the wagesa over your head. You can't just like ordain yourself, in a sense. You have to, somebody else has to be involved and do it for me. Like, they're my proxy when they put it over your head. So if you're interested in that, please go ahead and email me theinfo@brightwaysend.org. And yeah, just think about being, I also encourage, if for some reason you miss a class, a Tuesday class, or it's quite an ordeal for you to be here late, if you are in an easterly time zone, please consider joining Victor, who is in Brazil, for on Thursdays, and it's a couple hours earlier. He's going to host a precept study group, and only one person came last week. So please on Thursday. So it's 5 p.m. So that's a little early for those of us on the West Coast, but if you're on the East Coast, that might be perfect. So that's 8 p.m. Eastern time. So that's on our Brightways End calendar. And certainly, by all means, go to the class and to that if you are interested, because it should be a different kind of venue for discussing the precepts. Bob.
Yes. Could I remind that I am posting this recording of Tuesday night as early as possible on Wednesday, as I can get it done, so that everybody has a chance to listen to our presentation on Tuesday night in preparation for the Thursday night.
Oh, thank you, Bob.
So I just want to remind everybody about that.
Thank you. So yeah, on the website, so there's links in the newsletter, but that'll be a little too late, right? So on the website, I think it's under resources, audio, and then classes. Mick.
And then also, not to be like a goody two shoes or anything, but there also are recordings for precept classes from the past 2 years on the website as well. So like, you can listen. Those are wonderful. I've listened to a couple of those and they're really fun.
Yeah. Cool. Thank you for reminding us of that. And then, one day retreat a week from tomorrow. May 1st, Saturday, very sweet, simple, one-day retreat. Participate in all of it or part of it? No? Peter, you're shaking. I'm like, what? Do I have the wrong date? What?
I heard you say a week from tomorrow.
Oh, I have my mind, like, we're doing an Extinction Rebellion action on Saturday. And so that is like, I'm like, it's tomorrow. Sorry. A week from Saturday. Thank you. Thank you. A week from Saturday. All right. I think that's it. And then any other questions or things that I should mention? All right. Then I will turn it over to Gathel.
Better unmute myself or this might be short. Had kind of a busy and unusual last few weeks, so I'm not as well prepared as I wanted to be. I'll probably ramble, but then again, I was kind of planning on rambling anyhow. We're going to take kind of a wander through some of this, and it's going to be potluck too. We'll find out at the end what I mean by that. A few weeks ago, we were talking about emptiness, and someone said, I wonder what the word really meant back then, the Sanskrit written 2,500 years ago. And Alice came up and said, you know, the Chinese word for this is emptiness. And so I continued that search. And the term is sunyata. And if I'm incorrect anywhere, don't bother, or if Domino wants to pop in and say, where'd you get that from? Feel free. But sunyata means emptiness. It can be taken to mean emptiness. It's from sunya, meaning empty, nothing, void, and ta, which is ness, emptiness. The root of it is siv, S-V-I, which means hollow. Also, when the concept of zero was developed in India, which was a little after Buddha's time, sunya was used as a term for zero. So went all the way back and found, yeah, pretty much means emptiness. 2,500 years ago, it meant emptiness. And for the last 2,500 years, a lot of scholars and a lot of teachers have been discussing and talking and arguing about what it means. So it's interesting to see that, you know, that beginning. But the precepts I've seen called a practice, and emptiness is part of our practice. It's the term is not, the word isn't as important as the concepts behind it, that we hopefully will develop a deeper understanding as we practice. Another famous line from biblical literature is the sixth commandment. Although I saw someone else refer to today as the fifth, but still, it's thou shalt not kill. If you go back to the root of that, it does shed a bit of light, because in Hebrew, it's do not murder. So it's not so much a prescription against killing things as much as killing innocent or non-governmental sanctioned killing. Because it doesn't say not do not war. It doesn't say do not kill animals. It's don't murder people. One of the things I was reading today, though, has extended that to start including a much deeper meaning to it, a much more pacifist meaning. So even that simple sentence has evolved over time, like our precepts. The precept I'm talking about tonight is do not kill in its most basic form. It's the first of the 10 grave precepts. Their origins, which aren't always easy to find, but at least origins in Buddhism are back with our Theravadin school. And there were 5 precepts. Some say 8, but 3 of the 8 more pertain to ceremonial and festival days. There are 5 that pretty much pertain to living your life. And these were the minimum requirements for lay practitioners. So they, although there's lots of rules for monks and such, these 5 are for lay practitioners. Anyone who's taken refuge in the 3 treasures. And they are, according, and even though I've got the exact Pali terms here because of the Theravadin, when you look at the translations, they can be different. I mean, the first one here is undertake the precept to refrain from killing and injuring living beings. Another interpretation of that is I undertake the precept to refrain from destroying living creatures. So that's kind of where it starts in Buddhism. This is from the Pali Canon. And the first 5 are our first 5. And strangely enough, 4 of them are also 4 commandments. I'm just going to read through all 5. I undertake the precept to refrain from destroying living creatures. I undertake the precept to refrain from taking that which is not given. I undertake the precept to refrain from sexual misconduct. undertake to precept the refrain from incorrect speech, and I undertake to precept the refrain from intoxicating drinks and drugs, which lead to carelessness. That's pretty much the first of our 10 grave precepts. I'm trying to delve deeper and seeing where these come from, and I find there's really not a lot of agreement. Did these start with the Buddha? Some people feel the precepts started with the Buddha. Others feel that they are started further back. One amateur scholar said that he thought that the refrain from killing was there before the Buddha and was basically more of a governmental law, a king's decree type thing, and did it pertain to not killing animals. And but it's difficult to really tell, you know, what did they mean? Are they closer to the idea of do not murder, or were they really extending this to more creatures and beings? And I think one of the first clues is in the five trades that were forbidden. These five trades, O monks, should not be taken up by a lay follower: trading with weapons, trading in living beings, trading in meat, trading in intoxicants, and training in poison. So that gives a hint that do not kill is, they're not just talking about do not murder, but they're without, you know, refraining from weapons. And this is, once again, for the lay follower, not for monks. So, but I really wasn't able to find much agreement on, you know, where they started. It's kind of interesting. I was reading about the Vedic text, and they talk about the Vedic text being from 1500 BC. And it's kind of confusing until you realize that it was exactly memorized and that it wasn't written down until after Buddha. So it gets confusing going back. The linguistics studies are very good, but you kind of wonder at times where they get this information. So what does do not kill mean? It can mean more than one thing, but I think one thing I came across and one thing I'm comfortable with, and we'll get back to it at the end, but I'm going to bring up the concept now, is ahimsa. Ahimsa is refraining from causing pain to any living creature, also defined as nonviolent or respect for all living things and avoidance of violence toward others. It apparently dates to about the 7th or 8th century BC. It is referred to as nonviolence. And the literal translation from one person said means absence of injury, but another translation really translated as nonviolence. So that's 3,000 or more years ago, this idea of nonviolence, of non-injury. Here's another definition. Ahimsa precludes not only the act of inflicting a physical injury, but also mental states like evil thoughts and hatred, unkind behaviors such as harsh words, dishonesty, and lying, all which are seen as manifestations of violence incompatible with ahimsa. These are the words of Gandhi 100 years ago. This was not something that was a concept forgotten after all these centuries and millennium. Gandhi promoted it. Some people have said Gandhi was the founder of nonviolence. Well, he wasn't, but he did take this term from ancient times and from Indian philosophy to justify his concept of nonviolence. So is this, you know, it's hard to say if this is really the origin of Do Not Kill or not. But let me see where I'm at in my notes. One of them is Do Not Kill, Cultivate and Encourage Life. We are not trying to get rid of what we don't want, what we hate, or what we're afraid of. Another depiction of Do Not Kill is from Bodhidharma. Self nature is subtle and mysterious. In the realm of the everlasting Dharma, not giving rise to the idea of killing is called the precept of not killing. And Dogen said the Buddha seed grows in accordance with not taking life. Transmit the life of Buddha's wisdom and do not kill. And I take a large part of that to mean, you know, we talk about everything has Buddha's essence, Buddha nature, and that here Dogen is in part referring to that Buddha nature. If you kill anything, you're killing its Buddha's nature. Another organization is called the Zen Peacemakers, and they interpret this precept as recognizing that I am not separate from all that is. This is the precept of not killing or non-killing. They, you know, I was wondering then, you know, are we turning back? Are we coming back to the three precepts? And it's interesting. I mean, all rambling around, you find very different interpretations. I mean, there's one, I vow to refrain from all evil. I vow to make every effort to live in enlightenment. I vow to live and be lived for the benefit of all beings. And let me pause a moment while I find another sheet. Apologize for taking a moment. From our own precepts, cease from harm, release all self-attachment, do only good, take selfless action, do good for others, embrace all things and conditions. From the Zen Center, San Francisco Zen Center, also how about that? I missed that. It's the same as ours. They also the same with ours. Now, the Zen peacekeepers are kind of the furthest out from that interpretation. Their three precepts are not knowing, but giving up fixed ideas about ourselves and the universe, bearing witness to the joy and suffering of the world, taking action that arises from not knowing and bearing witness. They have taken the precepts and they've applied it to nonviolence and their ideas about peacemaking. So that's one of the things about the precepts. They're not a commandment. They're not a saying if do this or else. One person I read said, they're our practice. They're not something to be commanded that we must do, but they're something that we should practice. So I think no matter where the origin was of do not kill, if it meant purely do not murder, or if it was meant only in special situations. Someone did, you know, one author did point out that there were two kings during Buddha's time, and the one king was attacked by another. Well, the king that was attacked defended himself and he beat the other king, the aggressing king, but he did not kill him. He released him, and Buddha praised him for this. but it was kind of hard to tell by some interpretations. Is Buddha praising him for winning the defensive war, or is he praising him for the mercy of not killing this aggressor? And you know, I believe that author was kind of feeling that, you know, Buddha didn't say war was bad. Like, well, you know, the reality was this war was going on near him. He was aware of it. And the fact that the person didn't go total war and kill the king and such, that was good. It doesn't say necessarily that he praised it. So I believe that at this point, as we progress, I mean, I started at a different spot with do not kill. I know that we tend at times, when we talk about them, we kind of expand them into other things and saying, well, this also means this and that and the other thing. And I sort of was going to originally say that, you know, this is really one of the few absolutes. This is, says do not kill. But, you know, the more I'm thinking and more, I mean, one of the beauties about presenting a precept is you learn a lot about that precept. You develop a totally different idea by the time you're done. This isn't really just don't kill. It is really more the act of nonviolence, the act of ahimsa, as promoted by Gandhi, as promoted by Martin Luther King. As we go forward, as we continue to inhabit an earth with so many people and so many problems, this do not kill becomes, I think, expanded to this nonviolence that we need to practice nonviolence, and that ahimsa, I think, is behind the, obviously behind a lot of the precepts. I think it is really important to do not kill. Do not think of killing. Do not promote violence. And I said this was going to be a potluck. And normally we would break out in the breakout rooms, but I think I want to keep the whole group together. But I'm going to present some questions I think we should talk about. I got to change my view because, oops, what is this thing doing now? Whatever. Oops, no dumb wheels up front. I've got three questions to ask for discussion. And the first has to do with vegetarianism. Does the first precept mean that we should be vegetarians, that we should not kill anything to eat? Does anyone want to present an idea? Oh, suddenly I've got strange screens.
If you, I was spotlighting you, Gathel. So if you go back to gallery view, I think it'll be good.
I got two screens now. It's kind of weird.
If you want, if people raise their hand electronically, I can call on them for you.
Okay, yeah, because I only can see six people at the moment.
Drew.
Okay, so I'm going to answer your question with a question. I guess in order to know like whether or not it implies vegetarianism, what does it mean to kill something? So, I mean, like if somebody else kills the animal and I, you know, receive the meat from that, like I would kind of argue that, yeah, I'm culpable, or, you know, I'm somewhat responsible for that killing. But there are so many other things where you could make that same claim, right? I mean, you sit on a leather couch, or like any single animal product, or, you know, what about killing plants? Is killing plants different than killing animals or plants beings, right? So there's kind of these other other ideas, like other fundamental questions, I think, that come into play. So I guess my question, Gathel, is what does it mean to kill? Or maybe even better, like, what is life?
we'll stick with what it means to kill. That's a good question, because I mean to kill on one hand just means to slaughter an animal, whether you do it yourself or have someone do it for you. I mean, there is one Buddhist sect I read about that they eat yak meat, but they don't kill yaks. They let someone else outside of the community kill them. So they aren't killing, but they're taking the product of killing. And apparently the original Sangha was not vegetarian, because they begged for food. And if you were given meat, that's what you took. But they preferred and didn't want someone to slaughter meat to feed them. So, and then we say, well, you know, I don't eat meat. I eat cheese and eggs. Well, when that chicken that laid that eggs gets to be about 3 years old, they kill it. They don't always eat it either. They just destroy it. That dairy cow becomes a McDonald's. So, you know, it's hard to get away from the fact that our existence means killing. If you, you know, say, well, I just eat tofu. Well, if you ever walk through a soybean field out of the cloud, you realize that there's snakes and there's rodents and there's birds that have all been killed. So it's a slippery slope. There is no definite in some ways.
Tyler.
Yeah, I was going to, I Gathel kind of touched on this. I was for a number of years prior to, not for reasons of Buddhism, but I was, my family and I were vegan for probably 10 years or so. And it was for a lot of reasons that I was doing it environmental, and I didn't like the idea of factory farming and killing animals and that sort of thing. But as I think Gathel sort of, if you start focusing on your reasoning, I realized I was drinking a lot of almond milk, right? Because I wasn't drinking dairy. And that was coming from, even though it was organic and lovely, but it was coming from monocultured almond farms in California, which was drought ridden and having forest fires. And it complicates it when you start getting into it too deeply. And so we started thinking, the book I'm reading, which name keeps slipping out of me, but Mark told me what it was earlier, one of the precept books, she kind of says that, you know, you can't, with our current agricultural system, it's, even if you're a vegetarian, it's impossible to get away from impacts of climate change or impacts of killing. And I think it really complicates the question, I guess. And that's, I wasn't going to necessarily, Waking Up to What You Do. Thank you, Mark. I don't know why I can ever remember that title. But she talks about this a little bit on how, you can have, I think she's trying to get, intentions is a funny thing, so I think it can go either way, but how you're doing or what your purpose or what you're, how you're trying, I think is important as much as whether you're, you know, a strict vegan or vegetarian or meat eater. I was looking after some kids at a play school, and literally at 7 o'clock one night, they showed up at our house and they had been fishing for salmon with their community, their First Nations. And they just brought us a bunch of extra salmon they had, because it was a salmon run. It was like seven, and I had just stopped being vegan. And they're like, here are seven gigantic salmon for you to gut and deal with. And I was like, well, okay, this is weird for me, but also seems maybe better than eating tofu from as Gathel said, the monoculture agriculture. So it got, the more you dive into it, the more tricky it's.
Mick?
Yeah. I view these, like, the precepts in some sense in a similar way to the four bodhisattva vows, in that, like, I mean, good luck, right? Like, you're definitely, I mean, you know, they're like very nature is like impossible. In the same way, like, you know, like non-killing is like not possible, right? Like, I think somebody even brought this up on one of the Sundays a while ago, but like, we're all invested in killing a particular coronavirus right now, like with extreme like prejudice, right? And like that killing is an essential part of our life. And I think, to me, like the precepts are sort of like a reminder to me of like all of the things that are required to sustain, you know, my life, and to do it in such a way that is as compassionate as possible, you know, and sort of like more like the horizon than like something that you can do. I thought that was really interesting. And I know that, I did want to say something. Drew had asked about like, what is it? What is like, what is the extent of it? And I remember that Thich Nhat Hanh, who's obviously like a big like nonviolence guy, said something like, not killing, like you can't support any act of killing. No killing can be justified. But you also have to learn like ways of preventing others from killing, which I thought was really interesting and also like impossibly difficult. But I thought it was neat that he kind of like extended it over in that way.
Oh, Gathel, I can call on the next person, but if you want to jump in after anybody's
comment. That's a point. Go ahead. Was a good comment.
Right. Sam.
So if you go by the thought that eating meat that was killed by someone else, you're culpable for the death of that animal, you really can't get away from being culpable for death of other beings, even being vegan. Cultivation of plant food, a lot of pesticide use, a lot of bugs get killed. Or monocultures, even if you drink coffee, a coffee farm, coffee vinca monoculture, huge impact on wildlife populations, any monoculture. So all of the tracts of agricultural food, enormous impacts on wildlife. So, you know, even vegans can't get away from the argument that if a being dies in the process of the creation of your food, you're culpable. Just a thought.
Yeah, I would agree with that. That's it's difficult to. Well, I mean, everyone leaves a trail in the sand. If enough people leave that same trail, the beach erodes away. That's the problem. You know, part of the problem, I think, now with our harm to the world is the fact there are so many of us. And what is a single act does little harm. Each little bit of that harm can add up to a tremendous amount when there's 7 to 8 billion of us. Someone else had their hand up, Domio?
Not right now.
Okay.
Oh, Mac.
Yes, thank you. I guess I just wanted to make a comment that I think for me, it basically comes down to your intent. We could easily get into the weeds about how our effects and how our actions can cause a chain reaction that will go on. And eventually we would be culpable for harming something. But I think as long as our intents are to do as little harm as possible, I think that that's the best that we can do in today's society.
And I think it's important what Mick said too, and even though it's difficult, to not only do as little harm as possible, but to encourage others to do that as well. And sometimes that's merely by our example. Sometimes it's maybe speaking up when you see someone doing something that's foolish, that's, you know, unnecessary.
And Susan. Oh, you're still, oh, did you, was that by accident? You're still muted, by the way.
I can't, oh, now I'm unmuted.
Yes.
Yeah, I sort of wanted to agree with Mac. I've been vegan for a long time. And the animals that we do eat are animals that are sentient beings that have a lot of feelings, you know, cows and pigs. And so, you know, I'm not harmless, but I think I'm doing a good job because I'm not contributing to the suffering of those sentient beings. But it can't be perfect, so. And factory farming is a real torturous thing, so. That's it.
Yeah. I was reading about that earlier today. I kind of wondered, what do I do with the cows? Turn them to hamburger after about 5 years. They live to be, a cow will live to be 20 years, but they only give it five. Chickens.
Yeah.
What they do to the roosters when they hatch is horrid.
Yeah.
How they... what they do to chickens to stop laying is pretty horrid. So yeah, you know, our food, our process of feeding this many people ups the suffering. So is anyone else? I'll go on to another question. Let me skip my second one for the moment. And go on to my third. What does the first precept mean? We should not participate in or watch violent entertainment.
Mac.
Yes, that's one of the ones that I struggle with. I like martial arts films. I like action films with, and they have a lot of violence in them. But in Eckhart Tolle's work, he talks about this entity called the pain body. And it's basically a form of it, the ego that feeds off of negative energy. And I see how I'm influenced subtly by watching these types of movies and films. So I've decided to not watch that stuff anymore because I don't want to have that negative energy combined with the negative energy that's already in me in order to create behaviors that are sometimes unconscious and cause harm to other people. But I think that that's very interesting that I think you can be influenced by violent films and stuff. So I'm just trying to stay away from it as much as possible, even though I really do enjoy a good martial arts movie.
Oh, go ahead, Gathel.
I think I'll wait for Mick.
Okay.
This is actually really curious. Like, this is a really neat question because to me, I think that like, okay, well, you look at it and killing and violence in film and entertainment, it's not real, right? But then it's really interesting because if you think of this, if you think of the precept of not killing from the pure precept standpoint, there is no killing. If there's just oneness, right? There's no birth and there's no death and there's no killing. So I think it's funny because like, I immediately thought, well, the killing in movies is not real. That's a delusion. But then at the same time, like, from the one body standpoint, I don't know. I feel like something's there, but I can't quite think it all the way through.
Ruth Ann?
Our vocabulary reflects a lot of murder, killing, beating, winning, and that's part of our culture. We want to defeat cancer, etc. We are a violent culture, whether people like to admit that or not. And guns for hunting, where you're going to enjoy the food that you hunted because you don't take any more than you need to feed your family. That's different from gun sales. And so being conscious of our psyche being so comfortable with violent vocabulary, always winning, talking about the verdict over and over again because we have to defeat, still falls in that category of violence. And there's no space for mercy with that. Thank you.
We have Peter and Ken, but Gassel, did you want to?
Yeah, I'm going to jump in for a second and talk about, you know, we talk about culture, our culture being violent. And the truth of the matter is, you know, I'm an anthropologist, I've done a lot of study of a lot of different societies. Our species is violent. You don't come across many cultures that don't have weapons. I mean, the Maori certainly do, Samoans certainly do. The description of our early German ancestors is pretty bloody. The only real top of my head example of a nonviolent people are the Pueblo Indians, who would basically pull up their ladders and stay in their pueblos when attacked. It's extremely rare for them to fight back. To show how horrid colonization was, though, the one time the Hopi did rise up was when they rose up and threw the Spaniards out of their pueblos and out of their area. And so it was quite a while before the Spaniards took control of it again. So we tend toward violence, but not 100%. Possibility of a nonviolent society is there. It has happened.
Peter.
Thank you. I just want to bring up the importance of not being distracted. Zazen is important. And so I'm just very confident that I'm going to have a better Zazen if I haven't been recently indulging in something that's very stimulating, whether it's, you know, I just fell in love or I just lost my mother to a beheading or, you know, something just like all sorts of either, you know, the ball goes up very high or very low. You know, I'm making the point of what goes up comes down. And I just very much like balance.
Ken.
Yeah, this mostly pertains to the cinema thing, but I guess it sort of expands. There are violent movies where, like John Wick or whatever, where the violence has no repercussions. And there are other violent movies where there are consequences to violent actions, and you see the result of the choice to cause violence. And I think that that's a distinction that we need to be aware of, is it's not just the killing that we're talking about, but we're talking about how that what happens after the killing, like what's the results, what's the karmic results that extends that we don't see, you know? I mean, again, it adds to the impossibility of the whole thing. But in the movies, like, sometimes the bad guy gets punished. It's not, he doesn't just, you know, hi-ya, 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 and 45 people are dead, and it's okay, next scene, you know? I don't know, I kind of draw a line in there somewhere. I don't watch John Wick, at least. Thank you.
Okay. Franklin?
Yeah, I watched one John Wick movie. It was horrible. I could never watch another one. He just got like 25 out. But I guess, you know, I'm torn on this question. That's a really good question. I think, you know, there's the argument I've heard before that, you know, when we partake in these kind of violent films or video games, things like that, it becomes kind of an outlet, a way to channel possibly what Gathel is referring to as part of an innate part of our species. But to counter that, I think that's like maybe a lower order, you know, portion of our brain that's being engaged. And unfortunately these days, that part of our brain seems to get engaged more and more instead of less and less. And we do have this later developed prefrontal cortex that has things like empathy and things like that. And we have portions of societies like Quakers, Mennonites, et cetera, that do live nonviolently. So it's a good question, and I don't think there's a simple answer. I guess where I fall on some of this is that I wish that we found as much entertainment in acts of empathy. I mean, I've often thought, wouldn't it be cool to have like movies about Buddhists and, you know, I mean, there was a movie about Gandhi once, and there was the Little Buddha movie, which was pretty cool. But I mean, in general, we don't have like these movies of like selfless love or, you know, I mean, I could go on, right? It's not there. We're not interested. I don't know why. I'm interested, but I think I might be in a minority. Yeah, that's all I got.
Tyler.
Yeah, I just it's funny with violence, like watch killing and oh, my internet does say it's unstable now. That like with my kids and even with myself, like I don't promote or really like violent video games. But I think there's times when they get a little confused because I'll let them watch something like a movie that has violence in it, but it's almost kind of what Ken was talking about, not just to see a repercussion, but like of bearing witness to something that has happened in real life, right? Or like learning about the violence that happened, the killing of two Indigenous kids in Canada sort of thing. When they learn about that, there is a place, and sometimes movies or art are the best way for them to kind of be able to process that. And I suppose that's different, but sometimes it's another bare line where they're confused because they're like, well, why you let me watch this, but you won't let me watch that. When I've created some line of saying this is appropriate watching of killing and this is inappropriate watching of killing. And but I think, yeah, it's again, yeah, that's all.
Did you we have 5 minutes left, Gathel. Do you want to say anything at this point?
One last bit on violence, and I'm gonna conclude. I just read I listened to when I commute a very violent book. There's a lot of killing in it. There's torture. There are ghosts because the central character is a person who has killed people and their ghosts stay with them. It's social commentary. It's written by a Vietnamese man. It's called The Committed. And his first book, his name just went out of my head, is even better. And it really...
The Sympathizer?
The Sympathizer, right. The Sympathizer and his second book on this same character is Committed. And it's, you know, this person is violent, but it's really, it goes through where he got that way, from the French and from the Americans, and communism and such. So I suppose as long as we're a violent world and violent cultures, and especially the clash between violent cultures, a certain amount of what we would call entertainment, i.e. novels, books, some movies, is commentary on that, that will give us a different viewpoint on that. So it does play a role, but some of it's totally without any, it's just gratuitous, especially, I mean, I find it very, I actually won't watch a movie that has violence against women in it. And there's a fair number of them. And we were watching this very highly rated science fiction TV series recently, and it just has these long, dragged out fight scenes that don't really make much sense. And so, yeah, you know, there's a line. And, you know, I think as we, as a species, would hope become enlightened, we won't need the commentaries on violence as we start to eliminate violence. But I wanted to conclude with my own take now. I mean, after doing this, you know, I was going to, you know, as I said, I'm going to start, you know, don't kill. And that's what it says. You know, it's pretty absolute. But I'm seeing that this is really, and it's also a part of a whole of the, all the precepts taken together, is really do not harm, practice nonviolence. I think that to me is really the central part of that first precept. And I think it is really essential for my practice. And I think that it's essential that we as a people move that way, move away from confrontation, violent confrontation, and into conflict that resolves. I mean, there's always going to be arguments, but the ability to argue and reach an agreement. And hence, the first of the 10 grave precepts.
Thank you, Gathel. I want, before I do my the closing verse, just wanted to share that the I found an alternative translation of the Bodhidharma phrase after the do not kill, cultivate, and encourage life. So the in our Kyoji Kaimon, the first line in the little commentary paragraph, the first line is from the Bodhidharma One Mind precepts, and the second line is from Dogen. And the Bodhidharma ones are the ones like, then he restates it, and it's just, it's impossible. They're just, I mean, even do not kill is impossible, right? But this, the Bodhidharma one is like, no thought. And the translation I read was, no thought of extinction. So I thought it was really interesting. So no thought of like just wanting this thing, this being to not be. That's how I interpret it. All right. We offer the merit of this Sangha meeting to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Oh, thanks for being here, everybody.
Thank you, Gathel.
You're welcome. Thank you. Good night.
Thanks so much, Gathel.
Have a good rest of your day, Ken.
Morning, Ken.